did they start the Islamizing of America? Phase one, you come as peaceful. You're the victim. You come as immigrants. I need help. I need welfare. You come in the country. You introduce halal food. The woman wear hijabs. And it's like, you know what? Let's just coexist. Then we go to phase two. Phase two is like, phase two is kind of a little bit more aggressive in public. Now they're gathering in larger groups, like thousands, like New York City. Thousands of Muslims are gathering, praying in the street. They're now getting in political spheres, like Zohra Mamdani. They're becoming a little bit more public.
Wasn't it at LA?
Yeah.
LAX airport, where one of the shops was just playing the Quran out loud.
So
that you could hear as you're walking by. That'd be stage two.
That's kind of stage two. Islamizing. Let's slowly do it. New York City, you have, you know, food trucks playing the Quran out loud, bit by bit. Then you go to phase three. Phase three is where the UK is at right now. Phase three, they get very aggressive. They begin to get violent. Terrorist attacks increase. So Sydney would be going into phase three right now.
Yeah.
Knife attacks increase. The knife attacks in the UK is horrendous. Rape cases increase.
Yeah.
The UK, Europe has had 200,000 rape cases in the last 200 years. Sorry, in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
200,000 rape cases in the last 20 years by Pakistani Muslims. So that's phase three. Rape cases increase, terrorist attacks increase. And then you go to phase four. Phase four is now kind of where no one is there yet, except obviously Afghanistan and all the Muslim countries. Now Christians are called the infidels. Churches are burnt. Pastors are killed. Women are raped. Children become Muslim. So my warning to America is, if you don't wake up, you're going to be Islamized. And America have this pride. Americans can sometimes be proudful. You know, no, my country. And it's good to be proud of your country, but don't let it turn into arrogance, in a sense where you become ignorant to the fact that Islam is a religion. Is a conquering religion.
Yeah.
Islam conquers countries for a living.
Yeah.
And for 1400 years, they've conquered countries. So Muhammad, after he died, within 100 years of his death, Islam conquered 50 to 60% of the Christian world.
Wow.
So if America thinks, you know, Islam's not going to conquer me, that's just arrogance. Egypt thought that and they were conquered. Yemen thought that they were conquered. Morocco thought that and they were conquered. The UK thought that and they're being conquered.
Yeah.
So America needs to really wake up, or you're not going to be Christian anymore.
All right, Sandy Rios with you on Sandy Rios 24/7. That is a former Muslim. I think that they make the very best apologists for why Islam cannot be allowed to spread, especially through Sharia law, which is, that's what Islam is. It's the practice of Sharia law as written in the Quran. And so today we're going to be talking about that, because Islam is surely spreading and gaining power in this country. And we know this. We know it from New York City. We know it from what's happening in Texas right now. We see it in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and other states. We could talk a lot, but we're going to do that in just a second, because I'm going to talk to one of the leading fighters against this for 20-plus years, Frank Gaffney. Frank and I were partners in this fight a number of years ago. And he taught me much of what I know about Islam. He introduced me to the whole principle and why we needed to fight. It was right after 9/11 when I arrived in Washington, D.C. Frank came into to my office to brief me. And that's when I got on that bandwagon and actually ended up becoming identified by the SPLC as one of the 10 women in the country against Islam. And that meant they sort of put a fatwa on us, really, by showing our photos and kind of giving an idea of where we were geographically. When I was still in D.C., they did that. So I'm serious about fighting back on this. And I want to explain right away, because I need to, that many of you are believers in Christ, as I am, and you are, I think, maybe as I once was, confused about how you should feel about Muslims and Islam. I personally think that we are required as believers in Christ to be kind and loving as much as we can be to every individual person that we meet, that we don't hate them, that we have compassion for them. But I don't think that compassion means that you just put your mind on hold, or your intellect, or your understanding. You have to understand what they believe, what their intent is toward you and your family. As kind as they might be, as hospitable, their Sharia law is pretty clear about killing or conquering the infidel, and that's you and me. And one of the greatest enemies to Islam is Christianity. I really believe we are the ones that will have to rise up, and it will come at a great cost, because they are murderous and I'm not saying your neighbor is Muslim, your neighbor who's a Muslim is murderous, but that's what they are taught to do. And actually, if they don't behave according to Sharia, there's punishment for them. So it's complex for them and it's complex for us, but I still believe as individuals, we should treat them with respect and we should also share our faith. So with that being said, we're going to be talking about the hard truth about Islam and how it's spreading in Texas and other areas of the country. But first, one of the mottos of the Muslim Brotherhood is we love death more than they love life. We love death more than they love life. And certainly it's true as we get into studying Islam and its history, and also look at Iran right now, probably the strongest adherence to Sharia law in the world, maybe next to the Saudis. They love death. They kill people. They kill themselves. They kill others. They love death. And so we are not that. We do love life. They're absolutely right. We, the people of the book, believers in Christ and our Jewish brethren, we believe in life. And that's why we believe the unborn life is sacred. It's not like Islam. It's not like lovers of murder, which is, I think, what our country's filled with, even non-Muslims who just have murder in their eyes and hate. Not the people of the book. We have light. We've been forgiven. We know the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords and the God of all lights, the Alpha, the Omega, the Father of lights. That's who we serve. And so we protect babies. And that's where preborn comes in, because they do it in an absolutely brilliant way. And that is to provide an ultrasound for a mother who is pregnant, wasn't expecting it, is uncertain about what's going to happen. They show them the live pictures of their babies, those moms in utero. I remember when I saw my son's ultrasound was in its early stages when I was pregnant with my son, but I remember seeing it. It was blurry, not quite as clear as it is now, but wow, wow, it was a life. And imagine how a mom who's contemplating ending that life feels when she sees that baby. Well, I'll tell you how she feels. I think something like 80% of them moms decide to keep their babies. That's how powerful it is. So that's why we love Preborn as a sponsor. We are partners in what it is that they do, and that is save lives in a beautifully redemptive way. If you'd like to help, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. All right, so stay tuned, because next up is Frank Gaffney, my dear friend who was my tutor on all things Islam right after 9/11. We'll tell you a bit of that story and more on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Do you even know what Sharia law is? Feeding the poor, that's Sharia. Smiling at someone, that's Sharia. Being kind to your neighbor, education for every child, women's right to work, marriage must be between two consenting adults. That is Sharia. Respecting your parents, workers' right to fair pay, no interest loans so there's no poverty. The current court system is derived from Sharia. Democracy is Sharia. Hospitals have been built on Sharia law. We're already living under Sharia law. So what exactly are you fearing?
So if I had a laugh track, I would play it, because Sharia is not exactly that. And we're going to be talking about that today, because Islam is spreading across this country, across the world, of course. But we're going to concentrate on our country today. And I think central to the drama right now is the state of Texas. And we're going to talk about that and other states as well. And joining me to discuss that is my very dear friend, Frank Gaffney. Now, Frank is the founder of the Center for Security Policy. And in that capacity, I can tell you, he has covered the world with the experts that he knows, the information that he understands, his long-term involvement in this gives him so much wisdom on the issues we face around the world. But on the issue of Islam, by the way, I wanted to also say he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. And he is, as you know him, as securefreedom.org. We used to, he had a program on AFA for a long time, American Family Radio, where he discussed this and brought his great guests along. He's a frequent guest on War Room. And so that's just part of who Frank is. And I want to welcome him to the program. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Sandy. It's my pleasure and also one of my favorite things to do.
Well, we go back a long way, Frank, and I want to say something about that for a second so that people will know. I came to Washington, D.C. about 2 weeks after 9/11 had occurred. And for those of you that listen to me, have had for a long time, I was in North Korea on 9/11. Didn't even know what happened until the next day. So I wasn't even sure that my job as president of Concerned Women for America would be still in place, that there wouldn't be war, that none of these considerations of political things would even be an issue in an era of war. So when I came to D.C. 2 weeks, you know, the Pentagon was still smoldering and there were guards on top of the White House. We could see the White House from my office. One of my first guests was a man who I'd known from interviewing him from Chicago, but I'd never met him. And his name was Frank Gaffney. And Frank came into the office and sat with me and gave me the most incredible briefing that honestly changed my life. Frank appealed to, I don't think we can tell the whole story, Frank, but let's just say that the ridiculous foolishness of the Bush White House in regard to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is that is the representation of Islam in this country, 9/11 was ridiculous, so much so that George Bush ended up just days later telling us, forcing us to believe that Islam was a peaceful religion. And that was the beginning of a long tutorial by Frank on this issue. And I'm going to keep going for just a second. Frank really was a one-man crusade against what he understood was happening in the nation. And I guess I was his partner on much of this. And as I understood Islam more and more, I began to debate it publicly, and we kind of went to war. And our greatest obstacle was Republican leaders. It was amazing. And so I have watched Frank pay such a price for his principled stand on this, and I've watched him be kicked out of meetings, kicked out of organizations, marched out of the room when Muslim Brotherhood members were left in the room of conservative meetings. So that's how bad it was. So, Frank, when you discovered what you did on 9/11 about how that all developed, were you that concerned with Islam before that? I mean, were you that studied on it, given all of your knowledge?
Well, Sandy, you're getting into some ancient history, and I confess that my memory isn't as sharp as it used to be about what I had for breakfast, for example, 25 years ago. But yes, we had become concerned. You know, the job that I had at the time with the Center for Security Policy, which I'm no longer with, by the way, I now run the Institute for the American Future, doing similar work. But back then, we had become concerned in the late 1990s, really, about what Osama bin Laden and others that I now describe as Sharia supremacists were doing to try to attack us and cause immense harm. You know, there was an effort back in the early 1990s to take down the World Trade Center with a truck bomb in one of the buildings. There was attacks on embassies in Africa. There was an attack on the USS Cole. These were all signatures animated in part by bin Laden taking away from, tragically, my old boss Ronald Reagan's decision to withdraw our forces from Beirut after Iranian jihadists murderously attacked them there, you know, embassy as well as Marine barracks. So this had been going on for some time, and what we were trying to do in that window was to figure out why. And it was largely missing from the conversation. We were told it was terrorism. We were told it was these, maybe at best, there was these extremists who were, trying to manipulate or otherwise, monstrously mischaracterize the true Abrahamic faith of Islam. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. And over time, we focused in on what I consider to be sort of the operating code of Islam, and that is Sharia, a political, military, legal system, if you will, an ideology, some people call it, a doctrine, other people call it, a death cult, I call it, that has been animating the followers of Muhammad for about 1,400 years. You talk about an endless war. Well, that's yes. It. So anyway, going back to that ancient history, there's a lot of story that we'll leave out for the moment, I guess. But I saw personally on 9/11 an influence operation being put into place to get George W. Bush in the immediate aftermath of that horrible day to embrace Muslim Brotherhood operatives, literally, as well as their narratives, one of which was Islam is a religion of peace. Another is about that jihad is about personal struggle. Another is that the people who hijacked those planes were trying to hijack one of the great Abrahamic faiths. And like the little clip that you just played, all of this was what is known. It's a tenet of Sharia. It is something that Muslims are expected to do, required to do. That is, lie to the infidel if it will advance the faith. And one of the lies is that, there's really nothing here to see here, folks. Move along. There's nothing about Islam that should worry you, that Sharia is about smiling. I haven't heard that before. That's really rich. but the reality is, Andy, this... And we're doing a webinar, by the way, as we speak, in the immediate future. It'll probably be in the rearview mirror by the time this broadcast plays. But on the 27th of May, we're going to do a program about, is Sharia a religion of peace or a strategy for conquest, for war? And it is the latter, for sure.
Absolutely. And certainly, we've learned that. And I actually think some of our Republican leader friends are finally waking up to that fact. But it took a lot, Frank. It came at a price. Now, one thing I want to mention, that one of the things that you did with Center for Security Policy, as the head of that and the founder, you produced this little booklet, the Exploratory Memorandum. And I remember reading that. It was the game plan or the Muslim Brotherhood in this country. This was their own words. It was discovered by the FBI in a basement. If you want to tell that, you certainly can. But the phrase that I remember, Frank, was that we will destroy their miserable house from within. That was the plan of the Muslim Brotherhood for the United States of America. Now, Frank, we've come now. What? How many years? It's 24 years since that happened, something like that. How far has Islam gone? How much have they attained in this country? Without quantifying it, what have they achieved, do you think, in regard to that explanatory memorandum?
Well, I would say they've largely implemented it in terms of building at least the infrastructure and putting in place the cells and otherwise, attaining a dominance within Muslim communities across this country that were exactly the plan of this top Muslim Brotherhood leader at the time. He still is, actually. Muhammad Akram is his name. And he'd written this booklet, and our Center for Security Policy merely published it, and it is available for free, by the way, folks, as a downloadable PDF at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. You kind of have to look around for it, but if you put up in the search bar explanatory memorandum. You will find it. And take a look at it. It's only about 40 pages long. It's very easy reading, and it's very instructive. But the bottom line, Sandy, is this. I think we have not seen, thank God, to this point, the violent kind of jihad that, with the exception of, you know, some notable horrific incidents like 9/11 and that first bombing in New York and you know, murders at Fort Hood and this sort of thing. But it hasn't gone the full violent jihad that, you know, Muhammad, the perfect man, by the way, has taught is the preferred way to do this. But the rest of it, the stealthy jihad, or what Muhammad Akram called the civilization jihad, has been very far advanced in this country, and most Americans are oblivious to that fact.
Well, I think we can illustrate that by, let me just play this. This is clip two, and it'll tell us something that you know well. Let's listen. This is New York City right now, clip two.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Last week, New York City Mayor took a big step clarifying that the call to prayer can be broadcast every Friday from any mosque and during the holy month of Ramadan, no permit necessary.
We are committed to giving you the recognition you deserve.
The Adhan soon resonated throughout the prayer room of New York Islamic Center, the largest and most iconic mosque of Manhattan in New York City.
In particular, the young Muslims of New York will be very much inspired and connected with their tradition, with the mosques, and feel even more valued and appreciated.
About 3.45 million Muslims live in the United States. Approximately 22.3% of America's Muslims live in New York City. The Muslim community is rapidly growing on account of immigration, reproduction, and conversion. The state of New York also has more mosques than any other, largely concentrated in New York City. In 2015, there were 285 mosques across the five boroughs, including 39 in Manhattan alone.
As a Muslim immigrant in the United States, Adhan holds a very special place in our heart and every Muslim heart. It is very surreal to have that experience as a member of this community.
New York City is not an exception. Last April, Minneapolis made history when it became the first major city in the U.S. to allow mosques to broadcast the call to prayer using loudspeakers at any time.
Well, Frank, you know all about that. New York maybe is the most ostentatious, but it's not the only one. And I think it'd be good to just kind of stop for a second and help people understand why the establishment of mosques is not like the building of churches. I mean, how would you contrast that? How would you explain the difference?
This is such an important point, and I'm so glad you brought it up, Sandy. I go back to something I sort of alluded to a moment ago. If you believe Muhammad is the perfect man, and Sharia commands that as an adherent Muslim, you must emulate him in everything he did, everything he said, everything he proscribed, everything he prescribed, everything about him. It's a pretty ominous thing because the only way to describe the sorts of behavior that Muhammad engaged in is that it was demonic. And one of the aspects of that behavior was what he did with mosques or Islamic centers. And the Muslim Brotherhood has sort of trademarked the brand Islamic Societies of New York or Islamic Centers of Dallas or whatever. But whatever they may call them, mosques, going back to the model of Muhammad, were places, yes, where worship was conducted, but they were multi-use facilities. They were centers for the community. They were places where the leadership of the mosque, the scholars, the imams, the owners, which in many cases includes the Muslim Brotherhoods, basically direct and dominate the Muslim communities they serve. But they also typically were arsenals. Muhammad Akram in his book talks about them as being the places of the battalions. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey and a rabid jihadist, talks about them as the minarets being our bayonets. And, you know, these are the places where we prepare, let's be honest, for, as Muhammad did, attacks. Whether that's training or whether that's plotting, this is the kind of thing that I think, perhaps not in every single mosque in America, at least I would hope not, but I suspect in at least some, enough for no other reason, in emulation of Muhammad. So that's of grave concern. And when you see them building them out as they are, and not just these huge mosque complexes in some cases, but in the case of Texas, there's been an area that one of these Islamic centers, that of East Plano, came to be known, therefore, as the East Plano Islamic Center, or Epic City, where the plan was and is, I think, to take 404 acres, an area that's roughly four times the size of Disneyland, for example, and convert it into 1,000 housing units and hospitals and businesses and sort of fire departments and so on, to essentially create a Muslim-only enclave that would in due course, inevitably, because this is the way they roll, turn into a no-go zone, as they call them in Europe. There are abundant numbers of them there. And Sandy, my point is this. That is part of this larger plan of settlement that Muhammad Akram talks about as a key element of civilization jihad. You are immigrating people here. That's part of the jihad, is the hijra, as Muhammad made it from Mecca to Medina. This is bringing large numbers of those who are with the Sharia program so that they can begin effecting its subversion and ultimately its conquest of targeted societies. And that is the case with ours. The numbers here are relatively small still, 1.5, I think, percent of the total population. But in areas, as we see in Britain, as we see in Western Europe, in areas where they congregate, they can become a very sizable minority. In some places like London, I think it's 20% of the population now. And when that happens, building upon the infrastructure of these mosques and Islamic societies and so on, what they get, even if they don't have these communities, these centers, these societies, these cities, they have the basic, sort of sites from which to build domination, and that can translate into what I call electoral jihad, which is to say voting blocks that can, even in areas where there's not a huge Muslim population, nonetheless become the kingmakers in close elections.
Well, we've seen that
possibly
in Minneapolis.
Electing Muslims, possibly electing people aligned with them.
Oh, that's, we've seen that in Minnesota, of course, with the the population there that's Muslim,
the
Somali population. And actually, you know, the governor admitted that he needed their votes. They're such a big voting bloc that he does things to please them, including allowing the call to prayer in Minneapolis. So this is how it rolls. And I think
nothing of fraud.
Well, yeah. And then that
Don't
little thing of
that.
Fraud. Yeah. Well, and I think a point maybe we could make about the mosques and them being centers for, look, you think centers of worship, centers so that like-minded people can come together, but it's not that. It is, but it's for the purpose of undermining and destroying the country that they live in. They are there for our destruction, and they've been doing this. Islam's been doing this since the time of Muhammad. How many hundred years? 1,400 years, something like that. They've been doing the same thing. It's pretty boring, actually. They do it every single time. And that is, they believe in that ancient book, their holy book. They believe in that, the Quran. And they believe it's literal, all of it. And so it never changes. That is really, I don't know how, Frank, you would distinguish Sharia law from the Quran. Would you say that it teaches the Sharia law, or would you say that I don't know which comes first, but did it establish Sharia law, the Quran?
Sandy, the Sharia is built on basically two foundations. One is the Quran, and the other is the collected works of Muhammad's life. And again, that's where this idea that he's the perfect man and he's the model to be emulated comes in, whether it's his sayings or whether it's his life experience or, you know, the practices he engaged in or what have you. This is an interesting point, and I'm not sure that scholars of Islam would agree with me, but my working theory is that a wellspring of Sharia was that it had to square the circle on something that was otherwise kind of inexplicable in the Quran. There are passages in the Quran in which, for example, people are told to love people of the book. That would be Christians and Jews, basically. On the other hand, there are passages of the Quran in which the Muslim is called to slay the unbeliever, smite them in the neck and all that, wherever you find them.
In other words, cut their heads off.
How could this be? How could both of these things be, you know, the inspired revelations of Allah? And the answer to be found in Sharia is a principle called abrogation, which basically means that whatever came last or later replaced what came before. And the interesting thing about Muhammad's trajectory, his personal life experience, was he went from Mecca, where he was sort of poor and powerless, and therein found revelations that were love the people of the book and tolerant and, you know, peaceable and all that. He got thrown out of Mecca, and he made the first Muslim migration to Medina, and while there, he became powerful, rich, and a warlord. And in the course of it, the revelations that he got from Allah, we're told, suddenly turned very violent and, well, as I say, demonic. You know, and not only kill people of the book, but engage in slavery, rape women, you know, marry children, mutilate female genitals, I mean, on and on, just horrific stuff. And that became, because it came later, what abrogated what came before. So Sharia is based on the Quran, yes, but it's based on the principle that certain things apply, and certain things are considered important only to the extent that they deceive the unbeliever, or perhaps garner conversions. Mm-hmm. And you only tell them about the nasty stuff after they've, you know, converted and become part of the program.
You know, Muhammad, I know you know this, but I want my friends and listeners to know, Muhammad had a vision, and he wrote, as a result, one of the visions, satanic verses. He believes that was Satan. He said it was Satan. It was his wife who sort of persuaded him that it was not Satan. I just want to give an illustration of how twisted this all is. But also, Frank, bear with me for a second. For those of you who are people of the book like me, you're either Christians or Jews, Let me kind of try to explain Sharia this way, and then I want Frank to be specific about it, because it's, I don't think we've really defined it like we should, and it's hard sometimes. But think of it this way. As Christians, we know God's law. We know that the Ten Commandments, that's the basis, but we then know all the ensuing instructions of the apostles, of Jesus' teaching about loving one another as we love ourselves, of all of these kinds of things. And we have instructions about money and how to give and our generous heart. We have instructions about morality and our sexual behavior. We have instructions about going to war, really, and we have instructions about really all of life. And if you are a serious believer in Christ, which I am, you really want, Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. And so that's what we try to do in every area of our life, if you're serious about your faith. Well, this is how it translates to Sharia. Sharia is that for Muslims, but it's not good news what is in Sharia. And so let's talk about, and I think most Muslims, if they don't want to be killed by other Muslims, try to adhere to Sharia. It's a matter of survival, either survival for them. For us, it's we have free will. God does not strike us dead if we don't follow his law. But in Islam, it's different. And so, Frank, kind of explain, maybe we should talk about things like the Sharia courts. And actually, let me pause just for a second. Amy Mack, who you know really well, was testifying before Congress, before Senator Harriet Hegman. It's a short clip, and it's about Sharia courts. Clip 9.
I was actually saying earlier that right now in communities all across Texas, all across different places throughout the United States, from birth to death, they now have full operational societies, that somebody could actually be born in America and never have to operate outside of and deal with any kind of non-Muslim. So within these societies, they have their courts. And if you notice, most of the imams that are the heads that are coming from outside the country are Sharia judges. And these Sharia judges hand down these different, they use many different names. They will say that they're an imam, they're a Sharia expert, a Sharia jurist, etc. But if you go and you look, these are the people who are acting as the judges within these communities. And there's an entire organization around this. If you look up the Assembly Muslim of Jurists in America, they're issuing fatwas. We have fiqh council people who are also, again, that's a Sharia judge. These are people who are putting out fatwas that you can kill apostates, blasphemers. This is happening inside America. And again,
that's clearly a violation of the Constitution and the rights of the individuals who are involved in those tribunals, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so Frank, that's just one area, but kind of explain, please, a Sharia so that people can understand it.
Well, I go back to what I said at the beginning. The literal meaning of the word Sharia in Arabic is the path or the way, and it's described by Muslims as a comprehensive way of life that is intended to prescribe how you are to do everything in life. And as Amy was saying, if they have their way, they will create conditions under which you will live in America, cradle to grave, and exclusively under that regimen, that legal regimen. But it's more than just, you know, prescribing how you behave. It is also about what you are called to do, and whether that's the political piece or whether that's the military piece or whether that's the legal piece, you are called to conquer the Dar al-Harb, as it's called, as opposed to the Dar al-Islam, the house of war, as opposed to the house of Islam. Every place that is a non-Muslim society, a non-Muslim community, a non-Muslim country, not under Sharia, not conforming, not submitting, is the literal meaning of the word Islam, has it? They are called to try to bring about the triumph of Sharia in all of those other places, that Dal al-Harb stuff. And so it's very much, as I said in describing this webinar we're going to do tomorrow, it is Sharia at its core is a strategy for war. It is about achieving peace, as they say, by having everybody in the world submit to Sharia. And unless and until that happens, there is going to be war, and Muslims are going to be called to wage it. And let's be clear, Sandy, many, I think, in this country don't want any part of Sharia. I think a lot of them came here to get away from it, frankly. But unfortunately, they're what we might call good Muslims. They're thought of by the authorities of this program, Al Azhar University and the like, also the Iranians, by the way, the Shia. They're not good Muslims. They're bad Muslims. In fact, they're called apostates. And as Amy was just talking about, apostasy is a capital offense. And any Muslim can carry it out on their whim. And that makes all of those good Muslims very very nervous, understandably. So by and large, we don't hear much from them. I'm saying they keep their head below the parapet because they don't want it to be cut off.
Yeah. So also, and a couple of other things that come to my mind, Frank, about the Sharia banking, which is very prevalent in the United States mm-hmm. now. And one of the requirements when you bank with Sharia banks is that you give a percentage of your whatever money you have to wage jihad. So it goes to these terrorist organizations. That's required of you as a Muslim. The other thing is we didn't even talk about, and we don't need to beat this to death, but to use a metaphor, women have to be covered in the black burqas. They cannot go outside without their husband. They have no rights. They could be killed by their husbands at whim if they're not behaving properly. It is a horrible demonic system. And the Sharia law, then, is what Muslims adhere to. And I guess we should say, Frank, as an illustration of how crazy a serious Muslim can appear to us, we think of Iran right now. Who is? I just got this thing in my box. Maybe you've seen this. That the Khomeini is now, where is it? Where did it go? The headline here. The Khomeini is now criticizing. Shoot, I thought it was right next to me, but Khomeini's barking now, complaining, and the Iranians are now trying to put bombs again in the Hormuz Strait, which is so irrational to us. We've just devastated them militarily, but they won't quit. What's that all about, Frank?
Well, let me go back to what you said a moment ago because it's important to be clear about this. Sharia does prescribe a lot of things. The overarching thrust of it is you will do what you're told to do, point one, and what you're told to do is to emulate Muhammad. And that can take the form of violent jihad, which was his preferred form because it's the most efficient. He also, was, I believe, satanically pathological. But if you're not going to do that, Sandy, you do have an obligation to support those who are going to engage in violent jihad through what's called zakat. It's not just Sharia finance. It's what every Muslim is expected to do to, the sort of rough parallel is to tithe to the church in the Christian faith. But it's much more comprehensive than that. And there are eight things that you're supposed to be giving your money to, a substantial portion of your money, by the way, to, including one that is jihad. And I personally believe that that translates in many cases into money flowing to organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, to Hamas and its other, terrorist cells, and to its front groups, which promote them and otherwise raise money for them and so on. So all of that is sort of the backdrop. And then the issue of, what Sharia means in the United States is it means basically that whether it is through such direct or indirect activities, you are called to try to subvert the Constitution of the United States and replace it with Sharia. I think some call it, mostly non-Muslims call it Sharia law. Law is very much part of what Sharia is, so some people say that's redundant. But it is a comprehensive program, Sandy, and it has absolutely at its core this idea that it must be the supreme law of the land. And in our country, the supreme law of the land in Article 6 is the Constitution of the United States. So it is not only unconstitutional, Sharia, it is anti-constitutional. And then on top of it, most of the things that, you know, Muhammad practiced and that everybody's therefore supposed to emulate are illegal in our country. And you mentioned a couple of them. I don't know whether killing your wife is something you can do with impunity. Beating her for sure is. And under certain circumstances, you can kill her. There can be honor killings. She's wearing blue jeans, or she's not properly covered, or she's something else. She's not following you at appropriate distance. She's not only going outside when you're with her. Now, again, there are places in which some of this is much more stringently applied than others. But the bottom line is that under Sharia, those sorts of misogynistic practices are all not just condoned, they're considered obligatory. So this is horrible for women.
Yeah.
And remember, whether they're forced to wear the full burqa or just a hijab or something else, it is about subjecting them to second-class citizenship status at best and slavery at worst.
Do you remember that movie, Stoning of Saraya? That was I think I was there with you. It was premiered in D.C., and of course, it's about
Saraya,
Iran.
Right.
Yeah, and she was stoned to death because she allegedly was looking at another man. I don't even think they were accusing her of adultery. But my understanding, Frank, is that that men can kill their wives and their daughters too. Maybe it varies. Maybe Saudi's more strict. I don't know.
No. That's honor killing is certainly a thing. That is perfectly legitimate. But I think the more general practice of how you treat your wife is that if she doesn't obey you and whatever it is you are calling for, you can beat her. And they have, and under Sharia, by the way, they have, you know, some precise descriptions of how you do that. Again, I think based on the model of Muhammad.
The perfect man.
Ladies in this audience, please hear this in, you know, its most direct form. If this were to become countenanced in the United States, you would not only not have the freedoms you're entitled to under our constitutions and laws, but you would be enslaved, period.
All right, so Frank, let's move ahead a little bit because I'm because we need to come to.
You wanted to talk about Iran too, and I'm sorry.
We could talk forever.
Off onto a tangent. I'm happy to talk about that if you like.
Well, yeah, do that quickly, and then I want to talk about Texas quickly, and then we have to say goodbye. So, how does Iran illustrate what we're talking about?
Iran is a problem, Sandy, simply because the regime that has run the country. Now, I think less the mullahs than the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, are committed to Sharia and a particularly apocalyptic version of it that holds the world must be destroyed on their watch, by the way, in order to bring in the golden age of Islam and the return of their Messiah figure, the Mahdi. And so you cannot separate these issues. This is very much a Sharia agenda and a particularly toxic one. And when they say death to Israel and death to America, they mean it very literally and have aspired to it for decades and are working towards it assiduously. And if they survive this war, that regime under whichever, you know, leadership emerges out of this present group, there will be more war. There will be truly more endless war, and we must not have that. And I'm prayerful that the president will not agree to any deal that enables it.
I pray that, too. It's very disturbing. I wish we could talk more about that, because it's kind of a mystery what's going on right now, Frank, but it's distressing to a lot of us. I think I especially hate it for the Iranian people. I just can't stand what's happened to them. All right, so let's come back to America, because Muslims have really set their eyes on Texas right now. And New York, we've just talked about. Texas is kind of central, and they've built this epic city. They want to build the epic city, which is Muslim only, as I understand it. But it's been stopped by the governor. But I think really Attorney General Paxton was the hardliner on this, don't you?
Well, yes, but and we're watching with bated breath to see whether he becomes the next senator from
We're recording. Wait, we're recording on Tuesday, May the 26th, and we might get this show up by today. And this is Election Day in Texas, so Cornyn Paxton—that's the big race that—and also Chip Roy is running. His the outcome of his race comes today too.
Yeah, this is to be the replacement of Ken Paxton as Attorney General. But all of them, you know, face a general election as well. So it remains to be seen. But my point is simply this: I don't believe Epic City has been stopped. I think they're continuing to beaver away with it, and that's simply an example of how these guys roll. They are determined to have their way. They are building infrastructure, whether it's cities or mosques or Islamic societies or Islamic centers or whatever, front groups, buying up property. Every day I hear of another farmer who is turning over a large plot of land, even knowing that it's going to turn into a mosque or mosque complex or what have you. And it's alarming the people of Texas, so much so, Sandy, the good news, the really good news, is on the 3rd of March, in a primary ballot proposition that simply said five words, Texas should prohibit Sharia law. 1.9 million Texans said yes to that proposition. And what I take away from that is that when people in this country know what these guys have in mind, what they are trying to bring about, what it would entail for all of us, male or female, they don't want any part of it. And I think that's true not just of Republicans, by the way. It was a Republican primary, but it was an open one. But I think it's true of independents, good number of them, and I suspect some Democrats. I'm an old Scoop Jackson Democrat, for heaven's sakes, and now very much a Republican. But I remember when there were Democrats who, you know, loved this country and wanted it to be secure and understood that enemies abound, including these guys. So all I'm saying is that our purpose has to be, and we've put together a campaign, we call it modestly the campaign, to save Texas and save America. People can find out more about it at bansharia.com. And the most immediate thing that I would encourage all of them to do, especially as these elections are taking place, is look right there on the homepage, and you're going to see something called the Sharia Free Pledge. And I encourage you to ask your candidates, incumbents or challengers, whatever, for every office, not just...
And local, too.
In every
local
state, to sign the pledge saying you will do everything in your power to prevent the imposition of Sharia law on your constituents in this country. Everybody ought to be able to sign that. And if they don't, there's something wrong. And we need to make sure that they don't get anywhere near the reins of power. So this is, and by the way, also on that page, I believe as we speak, is now an interesting flyer that was circulated for three Muslim candidates, women, in a county called Fort Bend County in Texas. And they're all, you know, looking very modern and Western and, you know, liberated, pretty gals, all of them.
And it says, I'm holding it. And over them, it says,
we did a version of it with burqas.
Yes.
So that we could ask them, where are you on Sharia, ladies? Because if you want the country to go that way, you need to say so now, not look like you're doing something else.
Yeah, let me describe it again. It was from my eyes. I got the in my hand, beautiful girls, long hair, two of them real beautiful, very American suits, little pearls, Brittany Morris for judge, Sarah Kahn for treasurer, Sonia Jones for Fort Bend County clerk, all very respectable. Then you've got all of them in burkas, which I love. And that's what you say. You say the pretty pictures are pictures are the expectation. The burqa pictures are the reality. So just think that's, yeah, I think honestly, Frank, that's a brilliant way to handle this. And let me repeat, go to bansharia.com and you can find all of these things and you can find the Sharia free pledge to ask your candidates, because all of us are going through primaries and elections right now. And also, Frank, can they find out, can they join your webinar on May 27th?
Yes. On that site, there should be, if it's not up yet, it will be shortly, a registration page for joining us. And we would encourage them to do so if this runs before 1 o'clock on Wednesday, the 27th. And if it doesn't, Sandy, they can watch it after the fact. It should be very illuminating. And I'm very pleased to say, speaking of Texas, one of the guys who is really at the forefront of this fight is a fellow by the name of Brent Money, who is a freshman member of the House legislature. He'll be a sophomore next year when it reconvenes, I guess. But he is actually the founder of the Sharia Free Caucus in the state legislature, and a real comer, I think, in terms of both his understanding of this problem and his determination to fight it. And we need more of those people, not just in Texas, that legislature, but across this country. And that's why this really needs to be a national voting issue. And that is a central focus of our campaign. If people want to, again, learn more about it, or better yet, contribute to it, I hope they will, at bansharia.com.
And in closing, Frank, I just want to point out that this is not just happening in Texas and New York. And I want to remind people that when Barack Obama was president, he brought in tons, thousands, I don't know, maybe millions of Muslims from around the globe. He settled them in Texas. I think that's when that started. Nashville, Tennessee. He went to really red states and planted them. And also in Louisiana, there's a strong strain of Islam in Louisiana. And I'm not sure, I think even Indiana, there. Remember, Indiana had one of the first Muslim congressmen. So it's everywhere. I think we have to point out that it's happening everywhere. There are some more concentrated areas, but is there anything you would add to that, Frank?
Well, there, you could go through state after state after state. Minnesota, of course, is another one. Maine, even, is another one with Somalis deposited there. But you know, frankly, Barack Obama had the template and pursued it aggressively.
Yes, he did.
But he was a piker compared to Joe Biden, who just opened the borders, and they poured in. So there's huge numbers of them here now. And the trouble is, look, this is not to characterize all Muslims. I'm telling you that there are Muslims in this country who don't want this either. It's just that if they don't stand up and say they don't, and work with the rest of us against it, it's pretty much as though they're with the other side, or maybe they will be if when push comes to shove. But we're not getting their help at the moment. They're terrified. I get it. We need to protect them from, you know, being beheaded or otherwise harmed because they, you know, are leaving the faith or are blaspheming or whatever else that they're accused of. But we also have to be clear-eyed about the fact that this is a problem with enough Muslims, and specifically those that are largely dominating and manipulating and otherwise driving their communities, notably in these elections, that if we don't recognize the problem and resist it, as 1.9 million Texans have said they want to do, we will lose not just Texas, but we will lose the country, I fear.
Yeah, I think you're right, Frank. Of course I do. And I want to thank you for your heroism, really, in this. You really have paid the price. I've watched it. And you've just been steadfast, immovable, unshakable. And that's one thing I just really admire about you, Frank. So I want people to know that. And if you want to help, if you want to look, we're all in this together. And I would suggest you go to bansharia.com, and find more information than what we've been discussing here, and sign up for the webinar that Frank is holding on May 27th, which is at recording time here is tomorrow. So, Frank, thank you so much. God bless you. And is there anything else about where they could find you that I've left out? You know, you're still doing your minutes, right?
Yes, ma'am. I do a television program every day on Real America's Voice.
Okay.
And you can find it, and you can find those commentaries which you sponsored initially, my dear friend. they're called the Secure Freedom Minute at securingamerica.substack.com. And we hopefully will have basically everything that we're generating available fairly accessibly there. And thank you, Sandy, for this, the privilege of being with you always, as well as those incredibly kind remarks about the long road we've taken together. And I'm deeply grateful for your friendship as well as your solidarity.
You know, Frank, I will just stop for a second to take, honestly, I don't like to take a victory lap on things I've done, but on the issue of you doing commentaries, that was the coolest thing, because I know how articulate you are and how brilliant. And I also know, because I've done them, how difficult 60-second commentaries are for those of us who have a lot of words. And so I challenged you to do that and played them on my morning show for years. Then watched them take off.
We missed that platform, my dear.
Yeah, well, I'm proud of that accomplishment, because I'm just proud of that in a good way. So, okay, Frank, love you. Take care of yourself, and we'll talk soon.
Very good. God bless you, my dear.
Thank you.
All
right.
Audience.
Thank you. Ciao. Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Preborn makes it possible for us to have these conversations. And you all, so many of you have been faithful donors. Just amazing. You are amazing to me. I would say that, you know, Preborn advertises on almost all the major talk shows and podcasts. And our show performs as well as, from my understanding, most of those major podcasts. And you know why? It's because of you. It's because of you. There are fewer of you, but you give generously and you really believe in saving babies. And so thank you for that. I'm deeply grateful. I'm deeply grateful. And so for just $28, which is the cost of a dinner right now, in most places where most normal people eat, you can sponsor an ultrasound or introduce a mom to her baby for the very first time. And 100% of your donation will go towards saving those babies. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
In 1788, when the United States was barely a country,
right,
it was having its sailors taken as slaves by the Barbary States, the states of the Ottoman Empire in North Africa.
Tripoli.
Exactly.
Shores of Tripoli.
Shores of Tripoli. Ships stopped. Its crews carried off into slavery. We estimate 1.5 million European and American slaves taken between 1750 and 1815. Jefferson and Adams went to their ambassador in London and said, "Why do you do this to us? The United States has never had a quarrel with the Muslim world of any kind. We weren't in the Crusades. We weren't in the war in Spain. Why do you do this to our people and our ships? Why do you plunder and enslave our people?" And the ambassador said very plainly, "Mr. Abdulrahman," said, "because the Quran gives us permission to do so, because you are infidels, and that's our answer." And Jefferson said, "Well, in that case, I will send a navy which will crush your state," which he did. Islamic fundamentalism is not created by American democracy. It's a lie to say so. It's a masochistic lie, and it excuses those who are the real criminals, and it blames us for the attacks made upon.
So that's really interesting. That's a clip. That was Bill Maher's show, and that was Bill you heard for a little bit. The guest who was explaining our early dealings as a country, Thomas Jefferson, president, third president of the United States, dealing with Islam on the shores of Tripoli because they were killing, kidnapping, enslaving our sailors and worse. And he put that thing to rest. He took care of business because that's what Islam had been doing already for centuries. It was their pattern. It was what they did. And it's still what they do. Same pattern. Conquer and kill, conquer and kill. And so that is what's happening on our shores. And when you see mosques being built and when you see Sharia law being spoken about, just be wise. God asks us to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. In other words, we don't take a sword out and go kill our Muslim neighbors. We love on them and teach them about Jesus, about the true God. And that's Jehovah, Yahweh. He is the true God. He is not Muhammad. He is not Allah. We could talk about that on a different day, but they're not the same God. And so we want you to get smart about that and be honest about it. Don't be sugary, sweet, silly. Be honest about it. Be kind and serious about your faith to them. Represent Jesus well to them, because many Muslims are coming to Christ right now. It's amazing to me. Coming out of that, and it's very dangerous for them. So let's don't play games and be silly Christians as we can be in the West. Life is so easy for us, and we are so unserious at times. This is a time to be serious. Take it seriously. Take your faith seriously, and speak with boldness to your Muslim neighbors, your neighbor with a million tattoos and a ring in his nose. What, love them, but speak truth to them. And that's kind of my message for today's show. I want to remind you, in regard to what Frank was talking about, if you want to know more about this, go to bansharia.com, bansharia.com. And remember that pledge, Sharia-free pledge for all the candidates, your local candidates. Goodness, city governments are as important in this because it starts on the local level as a national candidates. And so fascinating. And I think, you know, the election in Texas that's taking place today, the primary, and I think of the senatorial primary between John Cornyn and Ken Paxton. I'm not a Texan, but I did meet Ken years ago when I was president of CWA. Ken has a reputation in many ways that has turned Texans off. I would just say that as far as activism and doing the right thing, Ken has a resume from here to eternity. No, that's an exaggeration, but maybe the corners of my room, all the papers would be filled with the good things he's done. And I think he struggles in his personal life, and I don't make an excuse for that, but I always say to you, look at what a man does, not what he says, but what he does. John Cornyn says a lot and does nothing. So I'm just saying, that's my opinion about what's happening there, but you have to make the decision. You're the ones in Texas who know better than I do. So that's it for today. And I want to remind you that Preborn again is our sponsor, and for all the right reasons. We love having them as our sponsor, and we love the fact that you do so much to support them. If you want to support them, if you haven't yet, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.